Good evening. My name is Terry Leary, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Rose I. Rosa, alcoholic. Thank you, Mary, for this privilege to speak at my home group. I'm a little nervous, but I know you guys don't really care. I'm going to try to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I got sober September 4th, 1997. And Pacific Group is my home group, and I'm thankful for that. And I am grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous. So let me get started with my story. You know, I came to you a broken alcoholic woman. I was a stay-at-home mom. I had everything that looked really good on the outside. I had the big house in Valley Village. I belonged to a country club. And I was a stay-at-home mom. I had two little boys with special needs and my youngest who doesn't. And I was run around Rosie. I was drinking and driving. I had to take them to their therapies and to their special schools in Cheviot Hills and Northridge and so forth. And my coping skills at the time were, rewarding myself at the end of the day with a bottle of vodka or wine, or sometimes it would end up being even a couple bottles of wine. And I don't know what my obsession was with cake bread 1985, but that was what I was always ordering. And I was also volunteering as a chairman for the Bruin Classic, which is for like 400 people, sit-down dinner, and I would always be negotiating the wine deals. I don't know why, but I got very good at it. So all the remaining cases would always end up in my garage. And the funny thing about that was, is I would just start with one, you know, and then by the end of the night, it was up to three. So these were my coping skills. And, I had everything. It looked really pretty on the outside. I had a wonderful husband. But little did I know there was three of us in the marriage. And these were the secrets that we had in our home. And so, of course, I don't know about all of you, but when I'm holding on to secrets and not doing anything about it, I'm drinking over them. So basically, I went on this binge of self-destructive behavior. And what that meant was is that I would drink to oblivion just to comfort myself and to ease the pain, the emotional pain that I felt in the marriage, as a mother, as a whatever it was, you know, as a woman. And I went on a 4-day binge, and I ended up in the hospital, and I was 51-50. And for those of you who are new, who don't know what that is that you pretty much lose your freedom and you end up in a straitjacket. So if you continue to go out there and think that you can do this on your own and pick your own clothes and end up with a straitjacket, by all means, go at it. Today, I'm glad that I can pick my own clothes, and I have most of my faculties most of the time because I'm sober, and I can show up and not in a straitjacket. I want to do a shout-out to the H&I because I went on this binge. I ended up 51-50. I ended up in an institution, and my best ideas and thinking at the time was I didn't like the institution. It didn't meet up to my expectations. I said, I'm going to order pizza for everybody from Maria's Italian Kitchen, which I did. But I'm a bit of a fighter. So what I said to the doctor was, and it kind of went like this. He said, you got to take this medication or you're going to have a seizure. And I said, I'll take the seizure medication if you let me order the pizza. So we got the pizza and I'm in lockdown and they delivered all these pizzas. And I gave them to all my little friends, my new friends. And so he had told me, he says, you need to go sit in an AA meeting. So I went into the circle, and there was people sharing. And in one of these occurrences and meetings, this lady began talking about how she had stuffed her best friend and put it in the curio cabinet. And I thought, give me the big book. I am not that crazy. And so that's how I ended up, finding you. That was my first aha moment. I got out of there. I filed for a divorce. It wasn't pretty. I had my own War of the Roses. And in that time period, my children were kidnapped out of the state of California, even though the judge had said not to remove the children out of the state of California. So that's how I know some of you know that I lived in Chicago for a time being, and I left. I got sober in this group. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Wednesday night. And with 8 months of sobriety, I flew to Chicago in Evanston, Illinois. And, I was sober through all of that. I ended up finding the Alano Club, which I was going to the meetings every day at 7 a.m. I made new friends. I want to thank Charlie C. for giving me the number for somebody. And I began faithfully going to the meetings every single day. I worked 3 jobs. Because even though I looked really good on paper, nothing was happening the way it was supposed to be happening. And I want to tell you that this is what Alcoholics Anonymous, this is how you represented in my life when I needed you the most. You came to my house, you dropped off bags of groceries, you brought platters of spaghetti for my children, you always made sure that I and them were always taken care of. And all I did was show up, and I was of service. I continued on, and I was going to 2 or 3 meetings a day because things were really heated. I became a target, and what that meant was that my children and I were targeted and put in many precarious situations and downright dangerous. And I stayed sober through all those life experiences because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Ooh, that was a hard one. I sponsored women. I had 5, to be exact, at that time that were going through the same life experiences that I was going through. And I can tell you that I didn't want to be of service at that very moment, but it kept me, it sustained me through my sobriety. It kept me going forward. I kept showing up to my children's schools, and my character was defamed because I was recovering alcoholic. I was deposed 3 times, and for those of you who don't know what that means, you're pretty much interrogated by professionals. And it was not easy. It was not easy at all. But I kept showing up because I knew that I felt safe in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You sustained me through everything challenging in my life, and I want to thank you for that. So that happened. During that time period, my son, the oldest who has Down syndrome, who's 16, was placed in an institution behind my back, and they told the institution, nonprofit institution, that I was dead. And that really was one of the hardest periods in my life, in my sobriety, because I didn't think people could be that cruel, and they can. And it was done illegally, but it was done. And, I've lived with that. I show up for my sons sober through everything. I communicate with my son, I've got 1 minute, by sending him care packages, and he's still in Illinois, and so is my youngest. And my son, Bill, who lives with me, he has autism, and he's been thriving in college. And, AA is so powerful. It is the core of what I do today. You know, I sponsor women. I show up when I say I'm going to show up. You've taught me to do things even when I don't want to. And the beauty of being sober is this is so priceless. If you're new, keep coming. You know, you too can have life experiences, not like mine, you can walk through anything sober, you will, as you can see, I have risen, I'm not dead. So with that, I just want to thank all of you. Thank you for my sobriety, and yeah, thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Steve W.
My name is Steve Whitmore, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here tonight. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Mary, my old friend, for asking me to participate. It is an honor and a privilege, actually, to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, and actually, in my case, to be asked to do anything other than to leave the premises. Thank you, Rose. Thank you for sharing that about the family, about I have a family and sobriety today. If you're new here tonight, we welcome you. We wish you sobriety, and it is here for the taking. When I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to hear these great speakers. There was a guy named Don P. who would say that Alcoholics Anonymous works, and it works good. And he talked about having a little table next to his bed, which was his AA table, and it was in honor of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, I am so grateful for this program. My sobriety date, and it is not my first one, is July 28th, 2016. I started getting drunk when I was 12. I loved getting drunk, by the way, if you probably haven't figured that out. I adored it. I used to, when I had a bottle and it had actually had a cap, when I would open it, it was just everything to me. It took a right angle world and it smoothed out the edges. I loved it. There was a difficulty with my drinking, however, when I got drunk, because I always got in trouble. Always. It seemed like every time I wandered out anywheres, I got arrested, or something happened that involved law enforcement, or involved parental disappointment, or how many times did you lie to get out of something? I euphemistically say that I grew up in the hood. We used to call it the Sades. For those of you who are uninformed, that's the Pacific Palisades. I was born into a wonderful family of pure advantage, pure advantage. My dad was a very successful actor in his day, and he provided for us, and everything that you would want was given to me. Obviously love and kindness, but all the material things. And at 12 years old, and it was an interesting thing. I was thinking about this recently. When I was growing up, I grew up in a household of artists and famous people, and they all were drinkers. They were all and drunks, but they were flamboyant drunks, and they were exciting drunks. And when you're a little kid and you watch these people, swinging on chandeliers and having a time of their life, you kind of go, whoa, I'd like that. Now, I overlooked the fact that you had to have some talent to attain this. You had to work for this. I didn't care about that, but it was the drinking. So, I wanted to get drunk. I wanted to experience it. I had a problem. I hated the taste of alcohol. I hated it. So I mixed it with treetop apple juice. Don't knock it till you try it. I was 12 years old and I got drunk, and it took a right angle world and it smoothed out the edges. And It allowed me to breathe. I'm so grateful for alcohol. And if you're new tonight, maybe you can relate to that. I'm so grateful that alcohol allowed me to live because I didn't know how to navigate the day without being drunk. I didn't know how to navigate the day. And the course of my drinking, the things that happened, I said I got arrested. I spent many a night in L.A. County Jail and broken hearts and broken dreams. And one night my very last arrest was Mother's Day morning. And I was driving down Western Avenue, just below Hollywood Boulevard, in a stolen car. I wasn't driving. My friend, who was illegally in the country, was driving. And we had our heads out the window, and we were singing Say Hello to Hollywood. And the LAPD at 3 in the morning came and made the big capture. They surrounded us, my friend, who I had just met, and he was a diehard friend, they let him go. Now, it wasn't his car. He didn't have a license, but they arrested me. And I, of course, when I get into the straits, I start whining, and I screamed in the back, seat in my best screechy voice, "What's wrong? What are you doing?" And they said to me that they had warrants for my arrest, and they took me down to the jail once again. And when I get in a situation like that, I call my mother. Mother's Day morning. My mother had many a time taken these calls, and this particular night she wept. When she picked up the phone, she wept. And I got my best dramatic voice, and I said, "Mother, don't forsake me." And God love her, she didn't. She put on her best pantsuit and came down to L.A. County Jail. Now, my mother at the time had just been left with my father of a 28-year-long marriage. My brother and his wife had just come back from the West Indies where they had lost their firstborn. These three people were in a house in a little apartment in Larchmont trying to put their lives together. And here I was, the drunk. Here I was, the person obnoxious, lying, just ramming through their lives, grinding out their heart. And one night, I was arrested. Of course, I was AWOL, but the Army was looking for me. And I called my mother and I said, so I couldn't be released. I was turned over to the Army. And I called my mom and my mother said, "You can't come home." And I said, "Of course I got to come home. I'll never drink again. I'm sure that none of you ever made that promise. I will never drink again. Are you crazy?" That night, she let me in the house. 2 hours later, I was drunk. And 3 nights later or 4 nights later, whatever it was, she had given me a photograph of herself. And I always want to tell this story because if I could remember this story, every day that there is a cloud in the sky, there would be a sun in my heart. She had given me a wallet-sized photograph of herself. She just wanted me to know I was going overseas. It was Vietnam. I did have a mother, and perhaps she didn't like me, but she did love me. So when she came back and she was crying, and it was 3 a.m. and I was drunk yet again, and she was that one question, "What's wrong? Why do you do this?" I held up that photograph that she had given me, and when I had her attention exactly where I wanted it, I took that photograph and I tore it in little pieces and I threw it at her. Because that's what I do. I hurt you because I have so much fear and I have so much hurt because all I want to do is be drunk and run away and be drunk. And, one night I was in the LA County Jail and I called my dad. And I share these stories because in sobriety, there's amending. There's something that happens in sobriety. I called my dad one night from LA County Jail and he hung up the phone on me. He said, "Well, I'm not going to take your calls anymore." And I called him back thinking he didn't know who I was. And, I reminded him by telling my last name, and he said, "Oh, shut up, Steve." And he hung up the phone, and he was to say to me later, I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't watch you die. I was 27 years old, and I was running the streets of East San Diego when Alcoholics Anonymous came and plucked me, literally plucked me off the streets of East San Diego. And the man that saved my life lived in La Jolla. And I was running the streets of East San Diego, and I was broke, and I was penniless, and I was homeless, obviously. I was could not long ago had stopped using the bathroom to go to the bathroom. Hallucinating were my friends. What are you, nuts? Jesus, they were my buddies. I just didn't let you know about it. And he would take me to a meeting. He picked. I turned myself into a place that did street. The best way to explain it is they were studying for their psychology degree and they did counseling on street people, homeless bums, me. And I went in there and I met a guy and he said, I for the first time in my life, I said, "I think I'm an alcoholic. I think there's something wrong with me. I think I'm an alcoholic. And he said, I cannot help you. Alcoholics Anonymous seems to have good luck with people like you. And there was a rotary phone, black phone. It was 1977 in his little office. And I called central office. And that night, a man came out and 12-stepped me. And I was to stay driver 6 weeks and get drunk, stay driver 4 weeks to get drunk, stay driver 2 weeks and get drunk, and I was going right back. And then God took a man named Will Campbell, who had 9 years of sobriety, and he put him into my life. And Will lived in La Jolla. I was running the streets of East San Diego. Will came and picked me up in East San Diego and drove me to a meeting in La Jolla. That one trip took him 2 hours. He was to do that every single night for the next 365 days. He was to pick me up, and he was to say nothing but, let's go to a meeting. And people would say to him later, why did you do that? Because he was such a schmuck. He was such a putz. I was not a desirable person. And he said, well, because every single night Steve would get out of my car and he would look back in and he would say, where are we going tomorrow night? I didn't want to drink anymore. I didn't want to drink anymore. And that was October 16th, 1977. And I have not had a drink since then. I have not had an illicit drug since then. However, in 2005, I suffered a debilitating back injury. I do not say this by justification. This is just by information only. And I was introduced to pills, and I abused them. I did not take them as prescribed. And in my mind, if you're going to take a medication, I have to take it as prescribed by the doctor who's fully cognizant of my alcoholism. I did not do that. So I had to change my date. And I wept when I changed my date. If you don't think your date's important, it is. And I wept when I changed my date. And that's when I came to I had known Clancy for years, and I got Clancy as a sponsor. God love old Clance. In the meantime, in my sobriety, time to stop, and I'm going to stop. You need to know that when my mother passed, I was at her bedside. And I said, Mom, it's okay now. It's time to go. And she looked at me and she smiled because she knew that AA had done something and that I was okay and I no longer needed her. And my father, when he passed, I was at his bedside. And he, one night, went before he passed, we walked through, I got to stop, but through weirdness and Alcoholics Anonymous, I ended up becoming the senior media advisor to the man who runs the jails. I became the LA County Sheriff's absolute senior advisor for 16 years. They used to refer to me as their most celebrated inmate. I walked the floor with my dad one day of the sheriff's office and all the regalia. And he took my hand and he hugged me and he said, I'm so proud of you. And I thank you for Alcoholics Anonymous.
Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you so much for inviting me. It's a real honor to be here. It's been many, many years since I've had the privilege of speaking here. I see Clancy a lot around the country at different conventions, and I really love the man. It's an honor to be here and to visit with him. He has inspired me since my early sobriety, he and Chuck Chamberlain. And I just can't tell you how much of the perspective that I now have, which is so wonderful, to be able to look out at the world and see an entirely different world than I used to see, and to live in that new world. And I owe to Clancy a lot of that. His creative way of explaining things has just always meant the world to me. I got sober on December 7th, 1964, up in Virginia, near Washington, D.C. And thank you. And a man came to my house in response to a phone call to the desk. And he walked in, and we were both in the Marine Corps. And he, there we go, Semper Fi. And he pushed me into a car, much against my better judgment, and drove me off to a meeting. And I haven't had a drink since. And he became my sponsor. And he was my sponsor for 42 years, 2 months, and 2 weeks. He passed away about 3 weeks ago. And his name was Bill Terwilliger. And so everywhere I've been talking recently, I've just been mentioning his name and how much I owe him and what a wonderful run we had together. When you got that much time of sharing with another human being, it's just wonderful. And I got to speak at the Manassas, Virginia group's 55th anniversary about 2 months before he died, and his home group was able to get him there in a wheelchair. And it was like the perfect bookend, because that was the group that he took me to at my first meeting. And so there we were, and in the same church, and it was just amazing. So anyway, I just wanted to thank Bill. I know he's watching and will be critiquing my talk later. Very briefly, you know, all drinking stories are the same. We just have different background music. But the core story is exactly the same. That we were having a hard time in life as a young person, that we didn't know how to fit in, that the world seemed confusing and people seemed better or different than I went to a church. It frightened me. It didn't frighten my sister, who was sitting right next to me. She still loves the Catholic Church. She's got 30 years of sobriety. And she thought it was the cutest place in the world, and I thought it was like Auschwitz. It just frightened me to death. I just detested going there. They're going to get me, and the nuns and the music and the incense and the Latin. And I was 9 years old, and I was staring at the crucifix, and it spoke to me, and it said, "Little boy, do you see this?" I said, "Yes." "Well, that's what God did to his only son that he loved. Guess what he's going to do to you?" And that terrified me. And so I terrified myself a lot. I just think up scary stuff and believe it. It's real easy. That's why I've started about a couple of years ago making this statement. And if you're new, I don't know, it'll figure it out. That if you were to listen to the talks I gave about 35 years ago compared to the talks that I give now, I have a much better childhood now. Well, how could your childhood change? My view of it changed. And I see it all differently now. I see it through the eyes of someone who's been transformed by this program instead of the eyes of a young kid who put a lot of crazy thoughts in his head. Our life is nothing more than a story. And if you tell a bad story, you scare yourself to death. And that's what I did. And that's why when they say old ideas availed us nothing, that's what they want us to get rid of. Well, I was wrong about that, wrong about that. That's what Chuck's talked about all the time. Uncover, discover, discard. What else am I wrong about? Oh, good, gone. That was a scary idea anyway. Of course, I knew none of this. I don't know anywhere where they give us a course on life like we get here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I just went along and put my package together from rumors, from misinterpretations of things. I got a lot of ideas off of bathroom walls. And some of the great philosophers take the time to share little things in there. And I would read them and go, "Wow, my God, that is really frightening." But I would never ask anyone. I just kept it inside. And I was 19 years old. I grew up in New Haven. I was a freshman at Yale, and I felt totally inadequate, and I just couldn't believe all the impressive people that were there. And then there was this little townie who worked on the buildings and still had his dungarees on, and I just didn't belong in there. And The pressure was just terrible. I just could hardly visit with people. And as I went to talk to people, I could see in their eyes they didn't really want to know me. And I didn't blame them. I didn't see why they would want to know me. And one night I had decided to have a drink. I was not going to drink at all, I don't think. I don't know why. But I decided to have a drink because my roommates were saying, you're in college, you ought to be drinking, and I'm at a little event. So I felt very uncomfortable. None of the guys seemed to want to meet me or talk to me. And so I went over and had a drink and talked to the bartender. I had a second drink, third drink. And I turned around and everyone in the room wanted to know me. I looked at their eyes, and they just all were smiling at me, and I could see in their eyes they wanted me to be their best friend. I couldn't believe how the world changed. It was wonderful. This was the world they were talking about. I heard people saying, isn't this world great? And I wondered what they were referring to, because I never saw a happy world anywhere. It was scary all the time. And as I went over to shake the first hand, I was ready to meet everybody now. I intuitively knew how to handle this entire situation. And as I walked towards the first man, I remember saying to myself, he is lucky to know me. And that was a new feeling. And so I talked to all the people. I felt very comfortable. It was wonderful. And I said to myself as they left, if 3 drinks does that, I wonder what 23 drinks might do. And I found out it makes you very sick, deathly ill. And you all know the first time you drank so much and the room is spinning and I'm slept in the bathroom on the cold tile and right near the toilet. Very convenient, very handy knowledge for later years that that's the place to be if you're going to be sick. And in the morning, I got up and I felt like I had a hatchet in my head. I felt like I was going to vomit, and it was just, I don't know if I'd ever been that close to death as far as I felt. And the thought occurred to me, are you going to drink again? And it took about a millisecond. And I went, of course I am. This pain and feeling like you're going to die is a small price to pay for what I had last night. And so my relationship with alcohol was so powerful and so life transforming that without realizing it, I had almost signed a little deal to give up everything in order to maintain this. Now, I don't know that as a young man. I thought I was just partying like the rest of the people. But I found out later that I wasn't like the rest of the people. There were heavy drinkers, there were people doing all kinds of things, and then there's the alcoholics. I later on joined the Marine Corps because the Korean War was on and everybody had to go in the military. I got in. I loved the Marine Corps. I made it through all the training about 6 months. I saw a movie about pilots. I signed up for flight school. That looked incredibly fun. Never been in a plane, and I got airsick going down to flight school, but I met a young woman, we got married, went down there, and after I got over the motion sickness, it was like I was born to fly. I would be second or third in the class as we went through all the different phases of primary and formation and carrier and gunnery and bombing and all that. And finally, I got all the way through, I got my wings, came to El Toro for advanced training, and then went overseas in a frontline fighter squadron, and the war was over, and all we had to do was fly high-performance planes and drink. And it was the most exciting thing. We drank as a unit. The colonel sat at the head of the table and bring my boys around to drinks, and they'd bring them, and they drank as fast as I did. You know how in some crowd you have to sneak off and get one on the side in order to, because they drink too slowly, and that was not the case with this group. And it was a wonderful tour, and about 3/4 of the way through, I was out on the end of the runway with the maintenance officer, a big Irish major who I adored. And he was talking about these guys who were practicing for the carrier, and they're doing this wrong. And he started mentioning that in 18 months he was going to be a lieutenant colonel. He'd have his own squadron, and he wanted nothing but the best pilots. And he pointed at me, a young lieutenant, and he said, I want you. And that felt like $1 million. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. And I drank with him all the time. I couldn't believe that he said. I have no idea what it was till I got to AA. And I realized that in the group of very heavy drinkers, my drinking scared them. You know what I'm saying? Alcoholics drink with an intensity and a relentlessness that is noticeable. You know what I'm saying? Boy, I'm drunk all the time, but that guy, well, I was the guy that they could point at. That I had no idea. So anyway, I went from one duty assignment to another. We ended up with 6 children. I came back to Pendleton. I was a forward air controller. I was a flight instructor. And during the last year of my drinking, or the last year of my flying and drinking, I was at Cherry Point flying the Crusader, which was a photo plane during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it was at that stage that the drinking caught up. I was having withdrawal symptoms in the plane. It was very frightening, but I kept flying for another year under those conditions. One time I flew with my hand on the ejection seat and flew the mission with the stick because all the buttons were on it, because I knew I was going to pass out, and it seemed like a very creative solution to the problem that how do you fly a mission if you're going to black out and pass out? And so that was my answer, that if I did pass out, my hand, I had a death grip on the seat, and it would fire it, and then I would eject. The plane would crash. The chute opens automatically at 10,000 feet. I'd be landed safely. And I remember thinking to myself, you really are clever. You know, that you get in these jams, but you always have a way out. And I often wondered, wouldn't it be fun to put that in the flight manual? Picture of me with the ejection seat and the stick. How to fly the Crusader during alcoholic withdrawals, because there was no such page. Anyway, it got so bad that I just had to go to the doctors and talk to them. There was no disease of alcoholism in the Navy. It was all psychiatric. And so they studied me for a couple of weeks, and they saw I had high blood pressure. I was confused, disoriented. My hand shook. And the psychiatrist wrote me up as having a childhood fear of flying that just showed up after 12 years of flying. I knew that wasn't accurate, but I had nothing left to fight. There was no fight left inside of me. I was beaten. I was just surviving. I was hanging in, trying to finish a career. And I waited about 3 months because you have to be given a new specialty, and I got orders to become an air traffic controller. I made it through the school somehow and was sent overseas, and the last year of my drinking, I was in charge of bringing planes in bad weather when they couldn't see the runway. And I'm very lucky that the senior enlisted men who run everything anyway took one look at me and would not allow me to talk to any airplanes. They would just go, Captain, you just try to get to work and we'll take care of everything else. And that was about all I could do. I drank round the clock now, no more 12 hours prior to flying. And I, very shortly, in a matter of 6 months, I lost 50 pounds due to malnutrition. I stopped hanging around. Didn't even go to happy hour. I just stayed in the Quonset hut, go down to work. We went on deployment. I would stay in the tent, drink vodka, and I was trying to get nourishment from soup and juice. Vodka and juice. I tried to eat some soup. I was just sick, sick. I run into some of my buddies years later after I got an AA. And they were both captains at the time when I ran into them. They were bird colonels. And they said to me one of the funniest, the most amazing lines. They said, you know, we knew you were probably dying, but there wasn't anything we could do for you. Now, the Marine Corps goes back after it's dead, even if it loses more people to get them. They don't accept the fact that anybody's going to be left behind. And here's two senior officers are saying, we knew you were going to die and there wasn't anything we could do about it. That's how powerful the disease of alcoholism is. They just gave up. What are we going to do? And so I came back to the States and was at a school in Quantico. I had a grand mal seizure, went into the hospital. They still couldn't figure out what the problem was. And after 5 days, I had the DTs, the delirium treatments, and you see all these horrible things. I got quite frightened, and I guess I was running around, and they grabbed me and put me in a straitjacket and locked me up in the mental ward for 6 months. And so that was where we were in 1964 in terms of an alcohol program in the military. And somehow the AA group in Bethesda, Maryland talked their way into the hospital. Said, we ought to bring a meeting in even if you don't have any alcoholics. And so that's how I got to AA, was the corpsman came in the nut ward, all drunks fall in, right face, down I'm there. I really liked it. I thought they were great guys, but I didn't think I had a problem. And when I was told if I ever drank again, my career was over. I was eventually put on an outpatient status to go home at night and weekends and spend the entire week in the institution while they got ready to send me back to duty. I started drinking again, and I was bringing vodka in the nut ward. And on Pearl Harbor Day, I just called intergroup, and I think my sick mind had the idea that I'll join AA, then if they catch me drinking, I'll say, the AA's made me drink. And somehow I could transfer responsibility to you all. But I wasn't bargaining on my sponsor, who just came in, and I swear he filled the whole doorway to my house and just went, hi, my name is Bill. This is a 12-step call. I talk, you listen. Then he talked to my family. He didn't ask me if I had a problem, and they all squealed on me. I'm the worst father, husband, terrible. He's the worst guy. So that's when he said, get in the car, and I got in the car, and I went to this meeting, and it was a group anniversary out in the country, and they had square dancing and fiddle players and speakers and food. They had every kind of food there was, and the meeting must have lasted 5 hours. And I was sober probably 4 hours when I got there, which was pretty bad. But boy, when you're sober 9 hours, I wanted to get out of there. I was trying to find a place to run to. I was standing on the front porch of this old place, and there was no street lights. It was December. I think it was almost sleeting and dark, and I didn't know how to escape. Which way do you go? And I was standing out there, and I felt this hand on my shoulder. It was an Al-Anon lady named Betsy, and I got to know her and her husband later, and I turned around, and she looked like an angel, and she said, come on back in. It's going to be fine. And I believed her. I just turned around and walked back in, sat down, and I've stayed. That was the end of the resistance. It just collapsed inside of me. Somehow I just went, okay. Complete misunderstanding, I guess, but it worked. I had another misunderstanding. I'd been sober about 3 months, and all of a sudden the gossip mill is going. Buzz, 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 buzz. Did you hear about Jerry out in the Vienna group? He had a slip. Pass it on. You know how we never gossip in AA. So I passed it on, but I didn't know what a slip was. So when my sponsor came over, I said, Bill, what's a slip? He said, you're not allowed to have one. And later on, I found out what it was. So anytime I thought of having a drink, I said, geez, I'm not allowed to. It was almost like they handed out permission slips. Okay, if you want to have one, you can have it when you come in. Again, I misunderstood the whole deal, so I never did take a drink. Anyway, I didn't finish my career. The Marine Corps got rid of me after 14 years. I was left out with my six kids. I had 2 years sobriety, thought it was completely unfair that this new loving God was certainly mistreating me. I went to meetings every night. I spoke. I made coffee. I did everything I was asked to do. And now the eight of us are out in the middle of Simon Legree territory. So much for trusting a loving God. So I had a resentment. You should have heard me at meetings. You know, they got tired of me coming in. Then we got a topic. Yeah, yeah, getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. I heard a lot of stupid advice. I thought if you people were really nice, you would go, thrown out of the Marine Corps? Gee, I own a corporation. You obviously need a job. Why don't you come by? I could make you like a senior vice president, give you a rental car, health insurance, and take care of your six kids. Yeah, yeah. Now, there would be some AA advice. Instead, I heard stuff like, just say the serenity prayer. Double up on your meetings. You got a lot of free time. Ha! Just take the directory and mark the eating meetings in your directory. Stick it in your pocket. Take it home. Feed your kids. Oh, yeah, yeah. But mostly they would say, just say the prayer of St. Francis. That was the big thing. St. Francis used to be a Marine years ago. And so I remember hearing all that advice, and I'm sure some of you new people have done that. And I go home at night and I go, I didn't really do a good job of explaining my problem because they gave me irrelevant advice that has nothing to do. I spent 6 months searching the steps after my sponsor told me the answer for everything is in there. I was looking for the money step. Never did find it. Then he had the nerve to tell me that I could use the program spiritually to get rid of financial insecurity without any money arriving. And I remember going, well, technically that might be true, but I'd rather have the other solution personally where the money arrives and that takes care of the financial insecurity rather than having it lifted. But trust me, that is the solution that works. That is the solution, the spiritual solution. Anyway, after 3 months, I read a story in the Washington Post where the unit that I was in, there was 12 officers that went around putting on a presentation about the Marine Corps, and they were killed going into Denver in a plane crash. So if life had been fair and I had been promoted, I would have been on the plane. And when I read that, I remember just going, oh, well, that makes things a little different. And then I knew God knew that I had just read that. I've been complaining to him 24/7 for 3 months. And I think I just mumbled something. Well, if you just told me that was going to happen, I wouldn't have been so upset about how unfair everything is. And so anyway, I ended up with several jobs and ended up with a career with the credit union movement, which is a wonderful, wonderful group of people. And I was a lobbyist for them for 20 years and retired to Tampa 10 years ago. And I love it down there. And I've been divorced a long time, but I have 15 grandchildren. And one of my boys is up in Redlands, and he's going to come down to Oxnard tomorrow, and I'm going to get to see him and his wife, and it's going to be a wonderful visit, and I am indeed blessed. I could go on all day about the wonderful things that have happened, the friends that I've made, the traveling that I've done, the watching AA in all its glory and how it goes through its little tiny missteps and keeps right on going, and it's just been a pleasure. But whenever I talk, I like to talk about the program, and so whatever time I got left. And I like to amuse myself, and so I try to think up things that I haven't talked about before, and then I'm not bored. And I was lying around this afternoon, and I thought about Dr. Bob's last talk, where he said, let's not mess it all up with Freudian stuff. Let's just keep it simple. I said, now there's an interesting theme right there. Keep it simple. And the more I thought about it, I said, you know, there's really two talks that could be given on keep it simple. One of them would take about a minute. And it would just be, you know, you mess your life up with all kinds of extra things that are absolutely unnecessary. Just keep it simple. It's how simple can we get it? It's that simple. Just keep it simple. Thank you very much. Go over and sit down. That would be the entire talk, because it's pretty straightforward, and there it is. Just stop complicating everything. Just keep it simple. And that would be a true statement. It would be a legitimate talk, and nobody could criticize you about that. But in reality, it's about the same as playing golf with someone who was born with a natural swing. And all they do is stand up over the ball and in an incredibly graceful, fluid manner, they simply take the club back and then swing it, hit the ball, and follow through. And every single time they do that, the ball goes right straight down the middle. They put the club back in the bag and they walk up and do it again. It's that simple. And when you watch it, you go, God, that is, look at. And great dancers are like that. You just look and you just look how easy that is. Artists are the same way. I watch these painting instruction TV shows, and somebody goes, this is how to paint a rose. First you start, and I really don't know where they're going, but they're talking the whole time. Like it doesn't take any effort whatsoever, and all of a sudden they just go, there. And then you look and you go, my God, that thing, that just materialized right in front of my eyes effortlessly. How simple they kept it. And that's what they would tell me with my golf thing. They said, you've got to leave out all those parts that are screwed up that you've got in there. And if you get rid of all of those, what's left will be a wonderful swing. And you know, that is exactly what our program is about. It is about getting rid of all the things that prevent life from being simple. I would say that the essential ingredient in having a simple life is God. It's the most important ingredient. It is the absolute essential for anything to seem easy and to come effortlessly is to stop being in charge and to go through the process of having all of the things that complicate it removed. And I was thinking the other day, I was sitting at home reading, I think I was reading Alan Watts, who's a pretty good spiritual writer. And I had about 10 minutes to kill before the meeting started, and it was before daylight savings changed, so it was dark. And the light that I was reading with, when the bulb just finally got to its end, you know how it does, and it goes, whoosh, and then a big bright light, and then boop, it's dark. And I remember the first thought that I had was, oh boy, I got extra bulbs in the kitchen. And I went out to the kitchen. I got a bulb out. There was a two package. This was the second one. I remember throwing the package away. I went back in. By the time I got back, the old bulb wasn't so hot. Took the bulb out, put the new one in. The light came back out. Went back in the kitchen and threw the light bulb in the trash can. That was it. Now, 40 years ago, if I was sitting home and sponsor told me to always read the big book, and I was reading the big book. It's dark, getting ready to go to a meeting, and the light bulb went out. First, it would scare me. Then I would have to figure out what that meant. Oh. Why did that bulb go out now? What? I'm reading the big book. Why would it go out while I'm reading the big book? I'm trying to tell. Maybe God doesn't want me to read the big book. I can't believe that would happen now. I'm just so dark in here. God damn, why does it have to go out now, right before the meeting? I don't know if I can find my shoes to go to the meeting. I'm gonna have to call my sponsor and I'm gonna tell him about this. This is the... I already had four horrible things happen. This is the fifth one. This could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Bill, Sandy, yes. I was reading the big with the light bulb, the bulb. It was like it exploded. And it's the fourth thing that happened today. I don't know if I can take it. I thought sobriety was going to be a little easier. Well, what already happened? Oh, I had the eyelash in the eye earlier this morning. You know, the eyelash in the eye. And I had to go to the neighbor when they got a handkerchief. I didn't know if they were going to hurt my eye. Then I was getting gas. I filled the tank up, and I noticed I have a 15-gallon tank, and it took 14.8 gallons. And I went, oh, my God, I could have run out of gas any second. Oh, my God, I almost ran out of gas on a four-lane highway. Do you know what it's like to run out of gas on a four-lane highway? It's scary, especially if you're in the middle lane. And before cell phones, you couldn't call anybody. And then I got to the noon meeting, and the guy was sitting in my chair. I couldn't believe he was there. And then I got home after work, and I came in. I was at the front door. I could hear the phone ringing, and I couldn't get my key. I could ring. I got over, and they hung up just as I got there. I don't know who it was. And then the light bulb. I said, what am I supposed to do? He said, replace the bulb. So I took the light bulb out and I went in the kitchen. Luckily, I had some bulbs. Took one out, threw the package away, went back, screwed the bulb in. The light came back on. And I sat down, read till the meeting started. Keep it simple. How do you just change the light bulb and never do anything else? To me, that's what spirituality is. The power to just be present at whatever has been handed to you in that moment. And to me, that's what our steps are for. To free us from the bondage of self. And the bondage of self comes in the form of stories that we tell ourselves. We don't have the power to simply enjoy every moment that comes along. We have to editorialize it. And it's in the editorializing that we cause what Chuck was talking about at his retreat, our separation from God, from each other, and ultimately from ourselves. And the first time I became aware of that and how powerful it is, and that's why the retreat that I'm working on back in Tampa is modeled after Chuck's and is trying to deal with this separation. It came to me when I was reading in the big book, God is everything or he's nothing. He either is or he isn't. What was your choice to be? And I remember reading it many times and going, very interesting, but went on. You know how it takes a while before you look at that and go, whoa. God is everything or he's nothing. Everything. And I remember finally going, you know something? Let's internalize just for you personally. What does it feel like if you allow that? If you allow that to be your choice? Let's just sit here and choose. That's what it says to do. That God is everything. And I went, okay, there it is. Boy, God is all the stars. He's all the people in here. He's this microphone. He's this book. He's that. He's me. He's you. We're all just extensions of God. God is everywhere. God is everything. And I remember taking it in as deep as I could take it and seeing how it felt. And it felt wonderful with one exception. I remember saying to myself, I can understand this and I can internalize this, but I don't know how to explain it, but it's quite apparent to me that I exist in addition to everything. Now, how could you exist in addition to everything? But we all have that feeling. We all have that sense, yes, and then there's me. You follow what I'm saying? Here's this wonderful circle that Chuck drew, you know, it's like that. Yeah, everything is in there, but I'm over here. I exist somehow in addition to the whole universe. How could you do that? It's very simple. You just make up a story that you exist in addition to everything in the universe and then believe it. And it is lonely in there. It is scary in there. And there's no God in there. And our journey, as we work through these steps, is to have the one word that is the whole point of the program in the 12th step, an awakening. An awakening, as if we can end the dream story and be back an integral part of everything. That is why this group is so powerful. Sure, we have our personalities, we have our individuals, and oh, thank God for all of that. But the essential power in this room is that you are part of this, that this is a huge whole that is much bigger and loving and wonderful than you are on your own. And you understand the great satisfaction of just being part of something instead of being everything in that old story where it's me in my little balloon story against the whole universe. And I suddenly realized that was made up. It was an illusion. And it's very difficult to break out of the illusion because we're going against our own mind. And my mind sees me trying to wake up and come out of this thing, and it wants to block it because he's been the boss the whole time. So we help each other. That's why Bill writes in the 12 and 12, people of very high spiritual development always insist on checking with others the advice they feel they got from God. Why is that? My ego is very good at changing its voice and going, hello, Sandy, this is God speaking. I'd like to tell you. Oh, thank you. You ought to go to Costa Rica and meet one of those young women down there. And this is coming directly from me, so do not run this by your sponsor. So I'm here tonight to tell those of you that are new, and you already know it if you're part of this group, that being part of something is spirituality as its essence. And you start out with your sponsor showing you how to be part of something, how to fit in. The great dignity of every other human being in this room. And that we slowly become part of this group. And then we're part of AA as a whole. And then we're part of the United States. We're part of the world. We're part of the universe. And we have an entire connection with our own creator. And I love that line in the very beginning of the big book. The absolute certainty that our own creator has entered our hearts and lives in a way that is indeed miraculous. He is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. The essence of keeping it simple is God. Thank you all very much.
Thanks for letting me share.
Days, we celebrate eight birthdays at this meeting for over 365 days of continuous sobriety. We give a cake with the appropriate number of candles on it, and we define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. So if you're a regular attender of this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please see me. What's happening? What's happening? Oh, the lights went off? Are on. Oh, I don't know. I'm reading people. I'm not looking at the lights. Anyway, okay. Whoa, I thought it was like some. All right, so that's good. Okay, here we are again. All right, if you'd like to take a cake, lights on or off, please come up here. And if you want to take a cake online, please email Kimberly K. at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org by noon on Wednesday. That's the deadline. And hybrid birthdays will be shown after the in-person birthdays. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each cake, for each candle on your cake. So at the end of the year, the candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. So you can see my assistants at the door when you sign up to take your cake. And if you are participating online, please arrange for this with our treasurer, Lon B., who's over here, at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org. And now we're going to sing briskly and speak briefly. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear A's. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back. Okay. Our first birthday is for Rose for 24 years.
Rose, alcoholic. Ooh, I grew in this program, you see. Anything's possible in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, God. Thank you, Clancy. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Pacific Group. Thank you, my AA sisters and the Women's Stag, the ladies from the Women's Stag.
And our next birthday is for Jerry H. for 40 years.
Jerry, alcoholic. Thanks, Mary, for the cake. Bob Z, my sponsor, couldn't make it tonight. Thank you for your living example. Chuck Nesbitt, who guided me when I was new for 13 years. The guys I sponsor, you up, Greg? All the people who take on the commitments and put on the meetings and answer the phones at central office. You know, we got so many things in the Pacific Group, the shows, we go out and answer calls, general service, golf tournaments. There's so many fun things and things you can do that are inviting to Alcoholics Anonymous we do here, and especially the, like, international conventions, we take hundreds of people in our group. The most influential man in my life was Clancy. And I thank him for all the traditions and the ethics and the dignity we practice here, and the yard especially, and most of all his witty and raunchy humor. We'll see you next year, I hope.
Okay, we have one Zoom birthday. That's all the birthdays in person. Okay, we have one Zoom birthday tonight for Sharin D for 14 years, and Sharon C is her sponsor. You all know about the court cards because they made a few announcements, so come up.